University of Colorado.
Welcome to See You on the Air, the University of Colorado's podcast. We feature faculty from across CU's four campuses and their interesting, innovative, and sometimes life-changing work.
Be aware of these deep fakes, but not afraid. And try to understand and notice that some of the news are fake news. From deep fakes, we end to fake news. They can be very painful for the victims. They can be very dangerous for the society.
The public, the society in general, just needs to be better educated about what it means to be fake, what it means to have fake news, what it means to be served an ad when you don't even realize it's an ad.
Welcome to See You on the Air, and today we're talking with representatives of the National Center for Media Forensics at the University of Colorado, Denver. We have the director, Kathleen Grigoris, and Cole Whitecotton, who's the IT professional. And we're talking about media forensics this morning, the scientific study into the collection, analysis, interpretation, and presentation of audio, video, image evidence obtained during the course of investigations and legal proceedings. The center is the only one of its kind in the United States, and it not only graduates top media forensic specialists, it and its students are helping law enforcement and the government in their investigations. Welcome, gentlemen. We're happy to have you here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Cole, perhaps we could jump right in. The topic of deepfakes is prominent in the media nowadays. What is a deepfake?
The term deepfake comes from kind of two different schools of things that are kind of going on with them. The deep part of it is the AI, artificial intelligence, using deep learning, machine learning, to develop fakes, face swaps, fake imagery, fake images in general. Particularly the deepfakes is actually kind of an open source, not really even a specific program, but just an idea that was developed by people. I mean, it hit the Reddit community first, and it was just kind of been out there. It's definitely an underground thing. But it essentially uses machine learning, computer learning, and AI to map features from faces and onto other faces and then to do face swaps with those. And it has a lot of implications. I mean, there's kind of the creative artistic side of it that movies, you know, you've seen movies that they're de-aging actors and they're bringing, I think it was a Star Wars movie that had an actor that had passed away long ago, but his whole character was brought back into this movie in a kind of a CGI way. This isn't necessarily a part of that, but this has implications for that. They don't have to bring actors back for reshoots. They can kind of just have their face mapped and then they can map it onto an actor or a body double or someone else that can be there. And then this also has, in the forensic world, implications for just fake media, fake images, fake video, fake news, et cetera.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of those implications here in a moment. The sense is that this is a highly technical, highly specialized thing, but with some of the software that's come out nowadays, it's not as difficult as it would seem.
It's not at all kind of in the realm of science fiction. It is definitely a reality. It's not necessarily in the realm of Snapchat and filters and things like that where people can just do it with their cell phones on a whim. It is very technical. It requires quite a bit of computer knowledge, quite a bit of programming knowledge. And even the stuff that was kind of just released into the world, the deep fake kind of package, isn't just you just install this and then you can go. It's something that you still have to fix and put together and you have to be able to manipulate and manage. And it's a constantly growing thing. It still takes weeks of computer processing, of having a computer doing this stuff in order to kind of develop these things. So, you know, maybe huge, large corporations, if you have access to huge servers and giant computer banks, those can be done in a few hours. But the most average person with one or two computers at home, it'll take them a week or a month to get 30 seconds of semi-believable footage. So
safe to say I won't be doing any date.
Yeah, not necessarily. So. But again, just it being out there means that, you know, creative companies, Hollywood might latch onto this and kind of develop their own tools, which then will percolate down kind of into the consumer world of stuff as well. So it's still there. It's still a thing. It's just right now it's not quite worrisome yet.
Yeah.
And aside deepfake, we can speak about face-to-face. Face-to-face is a previous generation of deepfakes when only half of the mouth and the face was edited. Now deepfakes, as we know, are one step further. We can speak about voice changes also, We are aware of a vocal project from Adobe, and exactly as Cole mentioned about faces, imagine deep fake voices now to replace somebody's voice and to do it on a very good quality, good enough to cheat or to manipulate people from an artistic like Hollywood effect. But from our point of view, we also know that it's much harder to cheat the mathematics of the samples and of the pixels if we speak about faces.
Question for both of you. Cole, you talked about the implications of fake media, and this is something that's very much pervasive these days. What are some of the implications we see for media? And we'll talk a little bit about legal proceedings here in a moment.
In the forensic side of everything, kind of the fear is the kind of inability to authenticate stuff. Authentication is a big part of what you do. If from the kind of civilian side, you know, my neighbor says that, you know, my dog's, you know, messing on his yard or something like that, and he has footage of it, and you're like, well, I can then say, well, that's not real footage, that's fake, or you edited it or something like that. And that's where the kind of world of deepfakes is that the more believable and more realistic that becomes, the harder it is to then authenticate that. And we have to look at other avenues for that authentication and for verification of that stuff.
Are there some prominent examples that have been out there in the media?
I think where the deepfake particular program kind of blew up was with a lot of Nick Cage videos, people putting Nick Cage into movies and scenes and stuff that he was never actually a part of. There has been footage of Obama, a deepfake of Obama's face on an actor, you know, basically making it look like Obama was saying and doing things that he never actually did, that type of stuff.
We're entering an era in which our enemies can make it look like anyone is saying anything at any point in time, even if they would never say those things. This is a dangerous time. Moving forward, we need to be more vigilant with what we trust from the internet. That's a time when we need to rely on trusted news sources.
Let's talk about the center a little bit. And Catalina, how was it conceived? And you've been in this field for quite some time now. And talk about kind of the progression of it and how the center at the CU Denver was created.
The National Center for Media Forensics started in 2008. It was a DOJ, meaning Department of Justice, grant to set up such a center, like a center of excellency, to teach the new generations, to create new experts in this very dynamic field. And starting by 2010, we had the very first students. And now we can speak about almost nine generations or cohorts of students, graduates, that are all over US and even Australia, UK, Saudi Arabia. So we are proud from this point of view to speak about international students or students that left US and they've been hired by some other organizations, respectable organizations from all over the world.
And we'll talk a little bit more about your students in a moment, but the center's also working with the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, which is part of the U.S. Department of Defense, and you're working to create some deep fakes so you can examine them and take them apart. Tell us about that.
Yes, we have a grant, and we work for DARPA to create, from a forensic point of view now, these kind of deep fakes or to manipulate videos and audios. I would mention that deep fake is just one technique to counterfeit or to manipulate people, counterfeit evidence and manipulate people.
So some of the audio forensics that you talked about, you've done for law enforcement, you've gotten some important results from that. Tell us more about the confession you captured, the I did it confession from you work with the Denver police in 2012.
Yes, it was one of the common, I would say, cold cases when some part of the evidence are just left in a cabinet, in a drawer, because of their low quality. And just by chance, a few years later, when somebody came back on this case and found the audio, it was just after a few days we had a meeting with the DPD, and we told them that We apply science on audio and videos, and we told them what can be done. We mentioned cold cases. They said, okay, let us see what we have. Later, when they came to us with this recording, and it was about a room with two people sitting, like for an interview with the police, and the police left, and the microphone was switched on, and picked up a brief discussion between them when one of the people, the suspects, confessed to the other one, like whispers, "I did it." This dialogue was covered, masked by noise, heavy noise. And just applying the science, we analyzed the recording, we identified the type of noise, some distortion as well. We fixed the distortions, we cleared the noise, and came with that very clear discussion between them.
And that person was convicted?
As I'm aware, yes.
Kind of the thing about the scientific stance of this stuff is that we're not necessarily there to chase an outcome, to come up with a particular outcome. I mean, that's the exact opposite of what we're there to do. We're there to look at the footage, see the stuff, look at it for what it is, and present what our findings are. And then whoever we're presenting them to, the Department of Justice, the lawyers, the civil cases, whatever, are then going to take that and do kind of what they will with it, which is hopefully, you know, presented in as true a way as we can. But that's what we're there to do. We're there. It doesn't matter what side we're on. We're not taking sides. We're not taking any kind of conclusions. We're there to kind of present this. So when a lot of times when we deal with this stuff, we don't necessarily think about or really kind of care what the overall outcome will be or what kind of happens from that kind of work. So not in necessarily a callous way, and we're not just saying like, oh, no, we're just here to look at the numbers and you guys put away whoever you want to put away or whatever, but that's not our overall goal. So it's easier for us to kind of just step back and to stay away from that side of stuff to make sure that we're not kind of tainting or kind of biasing our opinions, our point of views, that sort of stuff, so.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Just continuing what Cole said, our duty is to stay unbiased, first of all, mm-hmm. and to know the limits of our science. As forensic experts, we are never ashamed or afraid to speak free about the limits of the yard.
What are some of the other cases where audio or video forensics have helped solve crimes?
We can speak about both national and international cases. For instance, the very famous case of the Malaysian airplane shut down in Ukraine.
Yes.
It's a few years ago when a Malaysian airplane was shut down in Ukraine. And there has been a lot of recordings between the cockpit and the towers, also between some other people in Ukraine about the disaster. And the recordings made immediately after the event. Different types of recordings, some of them noisy, so it was necessary to enhance them. So in this kind of cases, we speak about forensic audio enhancement. And in some other cases, it's about speaker recognition, meaning to identify the speaker, like fingerprints, like DNA, or to recognize it and be able to say, likelihood ratios, who the speakers are. We can also speak about the Texas explosion from a few years ago, the chemical plant. We've been involved and we analyzed the footage.
How would you describe that technique, just in simple terms?
The techniques that we use mean scientific validated methods, meaning methods that are published so anybody can read and verify them. They are peer-reviewed, meaning that before publishing such a paper, it is like a blind peer review, so a commission. We are not aware who the members are. It reviews our manuscripts and decide if they are good to go for publishing or not. And in the end, we speak about scientific validated papers and methods published in this kind of peer-reviewed papers. And one of the beauties in this kind of forensic analysis is that we stay with the science and we are fully transparent. And we know that one of the most powerful weapons for a forensic expert is transparency. Always play, if we are allowed to make a joke, like with the cards on the table. No scam, no cheat, nothing like this.
I'd imagine in a field where fakes are the coin of the realm that being transparent is a necessity.
Absolutely. And there are many other famous cases like the Iranian missiles. Anybody can just Google and find them. We can speak about smoke on Beirut. And these are pretty impressive list of famous cases.
Yeah, I think the case with the chemical explosion, mm-hmm. specifically what that was basically a whole bunch of different sources of footage. There were cell phones. I don't know if there was any CCTV or anything like that, but there was a lot of different angles. All had different timestamps. All had started recording at different times and stopped recording at different times. So in that particular case, it was a matter of syncing things up, finding ways to actually match timestamps, match footage, match what was going on at the time to actually build a much more kind of conclusive and involved idea of what actually happened, of when certain things happened, when certain parts of the explosion happened, where they happened, how it was located. Some of the footage was, you know, a mile away. Some of the footage was a lot closer. So having different perspectives was really important for figuring out how it actually happened and what actually happened.
Whenever we speak about these kind of huge buildings or plants, their CCTV systems, cameras are oriented inside usually or outside, but we see the parking, so the around area. In these kind of disasters, it's extremely important to understand that the internal and external cameras do not depict the entire events.
Yeah.
So this is what why people that are like far away, as Cole said, like 1 mile away, but around the plant, using their mobile phones to video record the flames, the fire, the explosion, and it is necessary to synchronize, to bring all this.
Yeah, is that more difficult or easier?
It's a hard work to be done. It's a hard work, it's a time-consuming work, and it's a huge responsibility. And we can speak about frames. So we go at frame level when we run this kind of synchronizations. We use automatic techniques, but they always have to be verified. Like we also like to say, we never leave a computer to decide if somebody is guilty or not. Even if the computers are smart and fast enough, we always have to go back and to verify the results.
Yeah, trust but verify.
Exactly. And in the end, coming back to this kind of plans, it's extremely important for the investigators later to identify precisely the point or the area, the region of interest, the area the explosion came from, and how the fire evolved later. We speak about the dynamic of a fire, and it's extremely important for the investigators to understand the events, but based on top quality, enhanced and synchronized evidence.
Right.
Do you testify in court much?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I think one of our colleagues that's not here is the associate director. Is that
yes.
Jeff? Yeah, title. Jeff Smith. I think he testifies at least 2-3 times a year.
Exactly.
I feel like you are at least once or twice a year as well.
Exactly, like once or twice.
Yeah, it's kind of rare when the science is strong and the math, everything, the science behind it kind of backs everything up, and that science is strong. It's rare that you would end up getting called in the case or in to testify stuff, because usually the only reason why you would have to be called to testify is if the other side has an expert that's saying something different than what you're saying. Mm. So it's if that science is kind of rock solid and there's a foundation and it's there and you're not just kind of spouting off random opinions, you rarely get called in. So there are some experts out there that do testify dozens of times a year for exactly that kind of reason. But these guys, when cases come through these guys' hands, it's rare that they'll be called in to testify. And it's usually just to kind of explain to the courtroom or explain to the juries or something like that. It's not more of a something is being contested. It's more of like, well, this is a really technical thing and we need someone to come explain it, sort of thing.
See.
So, yeah.
Continuing with what Cole said, yes. Coming back to that case with I did it. This is the kind of case we didn't go to test in the courtroom to testify. So using the science that was described in the report, providing the courtroom very good quality, enhanced versions of the conversation, it was not necessary, in fact,
So you hope that your work is so good you don't need to appear in person.
Yeah. We don't say that we don't hope or we hope. We are just doing our scientific job, and then it's up to the courtroom, to the other side, to ask for us or not.
Right.
And yes, in most of the cases, they do not ask.
Audio manipulation is what the recording industry basically does in the creation of music, or it's a big part in the creation of music. And so there was recently a case where a Michael Jackson album was released after his death that was called into question whether this was really the voice.
Like in handwriting, we speak about normal handwriting or normal speech with normal phonation analysis. It's hard or even impossible, and we don't have the science to analyze whispers or falsetto and to identify the speakers based on whispers or falsetto or by singing. Yeah. When people sing, they stretch their vocal cords and their normal pitch and all the other frequencies go completely different values than the normal speech.
It's like singing is a mask.
Exactly.
Like you're not just using your voice. Now you're putting a mask on and you're doing something totally different. That's why accents disappear when people sing, all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. And also singing from a forensic point of view, we can speak that it's a kind of distortion. People distort their normal voices. I don't say it like they are trying to cheat or to distort the voices.
Or to fake it or anything.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's just the artistic way they have to go, like opera singers. If you have the chance to listen to somebody singing and then talking and pay attention to his voice, you'll be surprised to see that there are big differences.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about your students. Who are the students in the program?
That's an interesting one. They kind of come from all over the place. The master's program was kind of born alongside with the recording arts program out of the College of Arts and Media, out of CAM. So technically the master's is MSRA MF, so Master's of Recording Arts with a Media Forensics Specialist. So actually a lot of our students, I'd say probably half of them each cohort, come from the recording arts program. That's where I came from. That's what my undergrad was in recording arts, and I moved right into this.
So how did you get from there,
from
recording arts to media forensics?
So, I mean, me personally, I came back to school older than a lot of the other students that were around, and I was kind of done with the studio world of stuff, and I just didn't want to be an intern again and start kind of over somewhere else, and I wanted something that was a little bit more lucrative, a little more focused and specialized. So, but a lot of students, the reason why they're drawn to it is that media forensics, it's just media. It's not audio forensics or video forensics. It's media. It's all digital multimedia. So it's audio, video, image, as well as computer forensics, mobile phone forensics, just kind of general digital forensics. But we have a lot of students that are already in the field. I believe this semester we have a student that has been, or this cohort that has been in the field for 20, 30 years almost. He works for the Department of Interior. But we're the only master's program that does this, that offers this kind of stuff. So it's seen as really valuable, and obviously a lot of employers are going to see it as that way too, that you have an actual degree in what you're doing. So even if you've been in the field for a long time, it's still a valuable thing. We have other students that are photographers, that are other kinds of artists. We have students that are really just into mobile phones and that kind of digital world and into computers in general. We have other law enforcement students. I think most of our students that have come from kind of overseas, I think the Saudi Arabia students were involved with law enforcement and stuff like that.
And where do they go to? What kind of jobs do they end up with?
The market that's for this, there's a couple different levels. You have the federal level, the kind of three-letter organizations, FBI, CIA, DOJ, that type of stuff. But then there's kind of local law enforcement. You have all the police departments. That's probably the place where they need the most help. But it's also the place where they have the least funding, so it's kind of harder to get into those, but they definitely need a lot more of that. But then you also have the private sectors. Target has a huge forensic lab. They work with law enforcement everywhere, and so there's a lot of work in there. There's kind of labs for that. Walmart is a similar thing. And then there's like private consultation. A couple of our students have gone on to kind of start their own businesses. Kind of a common thing that students will do is they'll graduate, they'll go work in the lab, they'll either internship with the FBI or something like that for like a couple of years, and then they'll kind of start their own business doing consultation for other companies, and then also just taking casework for not even just large things, but just for civilians, for the civil cases. And then you also have the academic side, which is really what I was drawn to, and that's kind of why I'm kind of really happy to be a part of the center doing this stuff. But there needs to be the science. There needs to be research done. There needs to be papers. There needs to be the legwork, the groundwork of building this. And that's kind of the thing about this field is it's a relatively young field in the world of science. Obviously, digital stuff has been around for a couple of decades now. Computers are everywhere. Cell phones are being more prolific. But the actual science, the foundation, the papers, the research, that really just hasn't been there in a huge thing. So, like, you think of other FBI sciences, DNA, chemistry, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of science that is the foundation for that, and that there isn't a ton of science to kind of back up what's been done. It's just been the FBI and local law enforcement has just been kind of flying by the seat of their pants. As something comes out, they find a way to kind of detect it. And it's an arms race, like most stuff is, but it's very much one that law enforcement has not necessarily been the leader. It's really been the other side, the kind of underground that has been well ahead. And that's where we're at now, is trying to build it up and try and grow it to that point.
And it seems like a lot of those careers have rewarding aspects to them. I mean, you're helping to solve crimes, or you're helping to...
Definitely.
...to help truth emerge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's not just about convicting. It's not just about putting people away. It's also about, you know, exonerating people and helping the science in general. And then that's kind of the standpoint that we always take, is it's the science first. It is, we're never going to say that someone is guilty, someone is this, that this is definitely a match or this is definitely not a match. It's like, well, it's likelihood. It's consistent with, there's never a, this is 100% guaranteed. This is definitely what this is. So it's all about that science first, and it's not about trying to get an outcome. It's about trying to make sure the science is there to back it up.
And Catalina, we talked before, and you've been in this field since 1991, and I would imagine tremendous changes in that time. But do you find it's been a slow arc of change, or has it been a series of big bang changes?
I would say it was like a smooth transition from one generation to a new generation of digital equipment, technologies. When I entered the field, for instance, the audio CDs were at the beginning. And I remember us talking if they will resist or not on the market. And we still remember when we have a look on some older scientific papers, the digital audio tapes, for instance, which are also, we can speak about them as being obsolete. And we saw the advances of the new technologies in images, in videos, in audios. And we can speak nowadays, for instance, about a mobile phone, like being a small computer that is mobile phone as well, however you want, is the same. Being able not only to allow you to make phone calls, but also to act like a digital camera, to videotape, to make audio recordings, and so many apps that you can install on it. And we noticed this soft evolution, which makes sense now when we look back. And if we pay attention to what happened in all these 20, 30 years, we can be able to predict like what it will be like in 4 or 5 years by now. It just makes sense. This is just the normal evolution.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I wouldn't ask you to look ahead 30 years, but maybe if you look ahead 5 or 10 years, where do you see the field going?
We will see smarter and smarter mobile phones. And in fact, we will also start speaking about smarter and smarter new networks. We can speak about mobile phones. People are probably familiar about the 5G generation, the 6G. It's the same in Europe, when people also look and try to predict and to understand. When it is about the new techniques or technologies that are coming, some of them can be predictable or predicted, but some of them we already know that will come like in 1-2 years, because we know what's in the lab, we know what's in the industry, and we know what they are working on. We will start speaking about faster internet, for sure. We will start about speaking about new services and apps.
If you're looking for kind of whether it's an arc, whether it's a bunch of bursts, it's definitely been an arc. But I think everybody has this kind of view of computers in general. Like computers kind of showed up. They were what they were for a long time, and then they got better, and then they started getting better and better and better, and it's just gotten faster and faster and faster. That's really where all this is. I think if you were to look at the kind of forensic side and just the technology side, they would definitely correlate with just the proliferation of computers in general. And I think cell phones fit right into that. Cell phones are just computers, and they're a natural part of. You used to have a room, gigantic room full of, you know, 1 megabyte of hard drive space, of tape space and stuff like that. And then it gets smaller and smaller, gets bigger and bigger, faster and faster. And it's just we're in that natural evolution. So it's much more of like a logarithmic, you know, sharp curve as opposed to just a long kind of evolution. But with that, that also means, though, that not only does the technology kind of do that, but then that means our use of it and the way that people kind of get used to things and the way that people are just kind of assuming that, well, things have just kind of always been like this, as kind of gets more and more like that, too. And I think that's the stuff that we can see what's in the lab, we can see what's coming, and we kind of know the next couple of years of that type of stuff. Like deepfakes feel like they just kind of came out of nowhere, but it was a natural evolution of a lot of different tools, a lot of different things that have kind of been there. So,
and given all that, what are the implications for the National Center for Media Forensics here at CU Denver? Where do you see it heading in the next few years?
Our plan is to keep going with the scientific research, because aside the fact that we teach our students, we also run forensic analysis cases and also research, meaning that we try to provide, to create new methods, to improve old methods, and to always stay on top. And as Cole mentioned, the deepfakes, for instance, for us, it wasn't a surprise, because we have been familiar with the previous techniques. And I remember when we discussed, okay, if they are able now to manipulate half of the face, it's about a month or years until they will be able to do it for the entire face. Even when you do scientific research and you read the papers published by others, you understand the gaps in science and you try to fulfill them with new techniques to fix the problems in the science. And when you do these kind of things, then yes, you are able to predict or to understand like where the market is going and be one step ahead sometimes. We are not ashamed to just mention that on some of the techniques like deepfake, when deepfake came, for instance, we already have had the solution to detect them quickly. Mm-hmm. And this is why we noticed what happened in the media. And it was one of our very first reactions, like trying to recommend people, be aware of these deepfakes, but not afraid, and try to understand and notice that some of the news are fake news. From deep fakes, we end to fake news. They can be very painful for the victims. They can be very dangerous for the society. It's just a matter of time from the moment we load, let's say, the evidence into the computer until we get the results. And it can last like 1, 2, 3 hours, depending by the video, until we are able to come to a certain conclusion and make it clear that no, this video is inconsistent with an original and contains local traces of manipulation.
There's a lot of discussion you touched on about fake news, and we have this technique of deep fakes, and they can be closely connected. So what do you see as the role of media forensics? Or is there a role for media forensics to inform that discussion?
I've kind of long had this kind of personal belief or just kind of idea that science is, especially when it's used in a term like that, when people just say science in general, like science discovers this or science develops this, that sort of thing, that scientists are really good at looking at the numbers, looking at the backside of it, looking at the facts, finding these things out, but then they're not very good at disseminating that information then to the kind of public in general. So we can say we're not worried about deepfakes. We can see deepfakes. We can understand fakes. We can find deepfakes. There's so far nothing has been developed that we can't necessarily detect, that we can't find traces of. But the damage is oftentimes already done. The public, the society in general, just needs to be better educated about what it means to be fake, what it means to have fake news, what it means to be served an ad when you don't even realize it's an ad. And that's a big part of not necessarily like our direct goal as the National Center for Media Forensics. Obviously, we're trying to teach forensic experts, but that's kind of a hope of this in general, that our students and everybody that we're involved with, the community that we're involved with, the training that we do, kind of helps to spread that word, to get that information out and get that education out that it can then hopefully, you know, spread throughout the world.
We appreciate having you gentlemen here today, and this episode of See You on the Air, we'll try not to manipulate too much.
we'll come back with our rebuttal to everything after
we'll
that.
We'll give you equal time. Thank you for joining us for See You on the Air. The University of Colorado comprises four campuses, Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.